You already love the Mixing Music podcast, but what if I told you that there are over 250 exclusive episodes just waiting for you? That's right. On our Patreon, you get ad-free technical deep dives every single week on mixing, mastering, and production. If you want more knowledge, more techniques, and zero fluff, head to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start leveling up your skills today.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host DK, and with me as always is my lovely co-host, Localized Lou.
Hey, what's up guys? Yeah, don't have any fancy comebacks or phrases for today.
Yeah, well, welcome to the Mixing Music Podcast. Today we're going to talk about stereo and mono, and Lou is actually going to take a stab at this episode, take lead on this episode. What do you want to talk about specifically?
So it's just been something that's just been a little bit on my mind. And I guess you could say Greasy Will kind of inspired the mind behind this one. Because it's something that we, you know, when you're first starting out, you kind of talk about these things. And then at a certain point, it's just kind of a given detail that we all just become familiar with over time. And so you don't really talk about it because it feels almost obvious, but in a non-obvious way. There's sometimes I notice this when I'm working with certain clients or doing a certain job where like they hired me as the audio engineer. They don't know anything about audio. So they hired me to be the one in charge of these things and to prepare certain things. And so when they hear a problem, they don't know how to communicate it. And then to me, it seems almost obvious, but like it comes to realize like, oh, that's right. Not everything is as black and white as it is for somebody who doesn't fully know. So I wanted to talk about, I guess you could say like localization, how our ears actually hear sound and what kind of informs our decisions based on like what's actually coming through, you know. For instance, for those of you that don't know what localization is when it comes to human hearing, it's just how we perceive our stereo field. What sounds like behind us, what's in front of us, what's to the left of us, what's to the right of us. For instance, our ears are angled a certain way. Everybody's ears are different, and that actually creates a certain profile for the way we hear things. Like if you've noticed, some people will put their hand behind their ear when they're, weirdly enough, in studio. The first time I ever saw this in studio, I thought it was very weird. But they're just forcing the sound into their ear by cupping their hands behind their ear to kind of like create like almost like this like chamberish tone where the mid-range is more enforced and all that, but like our ears literally do that naturally. So it just kind of seemed weird to me that somebody would do that, but everybody has a different way of listening and checking things, so to each their own on that one. But this actually came up once again inspired by Greasy Will, because I saw two videos that he had posted up, and he was kind of critiquing two things that one is less obvious than the other, and the other one just sounded like blasphemy in the funniest way, which I couldn't agree with him more on this thing, because maybe this is taking once again, fake news. The whole idea is people are taking things out of context. They're only taking one line and then doing something with it. But what that one line said was wild, which was there was a guy who uploaded a video where he's like, since we hear everything in stereo, we should record everything in stereo, your snare, your vocals, this and that. And it's like, I always had to think if I can cuss on this, but what the fuck are you talking about? You know, I'm not stereo recording somebody's vocal unless it's for a very artistic reason. Like if you want to be able to like hear people swing their head left and right. It's a valid question. Yeah, exactly. Like you could use a microphone like the Rode NT5S, I think it's called, or the NT6. I forget what model it is, where it has two capsules already built into one mic. You could use something creative like that and actually have like a really cool aesthetic thing. But the idea that just because your mix is in stereo, everything has to be in stereo is somewhat blasphemous. You know, it's not really accurate or true to the subject. So it kind of had me laughing at that one. And then there was another video where I think it was Inside Blackbird, which I guess is one of the content creators for Blackbird Studios out of Nashville, was talking about the dual mic with a 45 degree angle on the second mic, guitar cab recording trick, which is you put a 57 on the cab, just straight on, another one at 45 degrees. And that can really make your guitar sound huge and stuff. You're still using it in mono, but you're using the two of them, but you're really introducing something called comb filtering, which is, once again, another thing that has to do with localization with our human hearing, because comb filtering basically means that the same source is being fed into two mics, but those two mics differ in like angle, timing, whatever, which causes phase cancellation and like very, very small amounts. But that little bit of phasing that you hear is called comb filtering. So this prompted a whole like just thought process of like, you know, this is true. This is why, like, a lot of people, I'm not saying that all pros have their own way of doing it. But at a certain point, there's like certain things that a lot of people just kind of leave behind because they find it either overall helped them in the long run, or it just was more of a waste of time or effort compared to other things that they could be doing on the same projects. And so one of those things that you see a lot of people move away from is like over miking sources, you know, or overdoing things in hopes of making things sound wider, because there's other ways to make things sound wider and also not mask the mix by over adding to it, you know, because at a certain point we're just adding blur to the mix by trying to add too many sources. So I kind of wanted to talk about the idea of all this, the ways we approach it, some tricks or tools that you could use to kind of enhance things, whether they be already in stereo or if they're just a mono source. You know, if we're just tracking a snare drum, how do we make a snare drum feel bigger, you know, than just a singular mono snare?
So this is already, for the episode, we're going to be mostly talking about recording and a little bit on mixing.
Yeah.
But we're going to be talking about like phase correlation and techniques in the recording process, especially with multiple mics. Mm-hmm. I will have to say, as a preface, I have, like, obviously the main thing that most people are going to be thinking about is like multi-mics on a drum kit or recording a band in a single room, like as a live take. But I think that this may even go into like recording in an entire orchestra on a stage or in a theater.
Oh yeah, which is actually pretty famously under-miked or over-miked.
Yeah, so we're going to talk a little bit about that, but I'm going to be honest and say I have less experience with that. I've only done that a few times. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't done that enough where like I feel very confident about it, but I can definitely speak a little bit on it. And that's really interesting too, because then we could talk about mixing from that perspective. Like, how do you mix an orchestra that was recorded on a stage or in a theater with like 40 to 50 mics at a single go in a single room?
And some of them being like Decatree mics, where you have like 3-4 microphones on top of a really, really tall stand or hanging from the ceiling that are recording the orchestra from like 40, 50 feet away from the orchestra to capture the overall picture of it in that case. But then there's still closed mic too. How do you manage the timing between microphones and I guess the relationship of, should you time align them? Should you not? What's the whole idea behind it?
Yeah. So let's get into it then. I think to your point, having, just because you can have more mics and you have infinite number of inputs that you can use, doesn't mean using them is the best for the fidelity of the song. There is going to be here's the problem with like comb filtering or any sort of like phase correlation type thing. This is the nature of recorded audio and stacking recorded audio. Mm-hmm. Like phase isn't necessarily a big issue in the real world, where you're like stacking individual clips and summing them together. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like when you hear two things, like a single French horn with two ears, they're not really going out of phase in your, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Like it's different. If you hear things out of phase, like in a studio or in a movie theater or even from like a live audience, like in a live stage or live sound, right? Like you'll notice it feels unnatural. It's a non-natural occurrence for the most part. And so we want to, it doesn't take a special ear to pick it up. And it's pretty quite obvious even to the untrained ear. And it's an issue that we need to mitigate and manage. And it's not like a completely 100% solvable issue. Like this is the inherent nature of recorded audio. So we need to, again, I said those words carefully, like mitigate and manage those problems and minimize those problems as much as possible and at least be aware of them.
Yeah. A good example of where I guess you could say natural comb filtering would be is if you're listening to something in a room. It could just be a loud speaker or a Bluetooth speaker in the corner, right? And it bounces off all the walls versus like when you listen to something in your headphones, that's kind of one of those clear examples of like, okay, there's going to be natural occurrences that happen around you. So, you know, when we talk about comb filtering in a space, that's kind of a really quick and dirty answer as to like when you can hear it. You know, you don't, things don't sound as clear. The voice is bouncing off the walls, which causes it to sound almost echoey, almost thin sometimes versus a solid, pure sounding like sound. So like when you talk to somebody in a room and they take a couple steps away from you, they went from sounding very clear and direct right in front of you to like, oh, I hear more of the room than I hear more of the direct sound. And that's kind of a good example of like comb filtering or the room playing a factor in what you're capturing. So, you know, when we're actually recording something and we want it to sound bigger, that's kind of a really good example of why you don't actually always need two mics for things to sound bigger in your mix. Sometimes the bigger is really just the mono reverb. And that kind of goes into something that is kind of pretty commonly practiced so much in Nashville that they just call it the Nashville guitar trick, which is kind of a funny thing. When I first heard that, I was like, what is the Nashville guitar trick? It's as simple as this. You still record the guitar just as you initially planned. You know, you just use a 57 in front of it or a Behr or 87, whatever you want to use. Everybody's got a different mic of choice. Everybody's got a different guitar of choice, amp of choice, whatever. It doesn't really matter for this trick. But what does matter is the idea that you don't need to double mic it. In double miking the guitar cab, there is, you know, comb filtering is going to be a play factor. There are ways around it, which I wanted to bring up, which is like the 3-to-1 rule. You give the microphone 3 times the distance between themselves versus the mic and the source itself. So if the source is only 1 inch away, you give it about 3 inches away from the next mic, assuming that you can have that amount of distance and work around it for the same source, which already becomes kind of a nightmare thing when you're talking about recording something like drums. And this is usually when you're talking about a mono source. You know, so this isn't necessarily something where you're recording something that's in stereo. This doesn't really play in the same effect. You can have just one mic on each speaker or wherever the source is coming from, and you shouldn't really have any phase issues because it's a stereo source unless you're doing some weird miking with it. But other ways that we normally see multi-miking go well for something would be like overheads on drums. You know, we do it like an equal distance triangle. You know, easy way to check this out is go right in between your snare and your kick drum. You get a piece of string, a tape measure, an XLR cable where you pinch one end right up against the snare and you pinch the other end right up against one of the overheads. And you try to see if each one of the mics is the same distance away from the snare and the same distance from each other. This is where, TK, I know I'm going to butcher the fuck out of this. So you correct me. I'm guessing you'll remember this. It's Glenn Jones drum trick, mono overhead above, one behind the floor tom. Who's the guy that came up with the miking technique? Yeah. Point is, the practice matters more than the name, unfortunately. Sorry, Glenn, or whatever your name is. No disrespect to you. Thank you for the trick. But that trick was actually found as an accident because of just leaving mics up while tracking things and accidentally arming things at the wrong time, which is kind of a funny story as to how almost everything was found out. But he basically put one overhead just right above the snare and then put another mic that was just off to the side, which just happened to be equal distant. And when you pan one hard left and one hard right, the snare stayed in the middle. you know, and that's kind of the whole point of that trick, using equal distant mics from each other to the source. And that will help with things sounding, I guess you could say, bigger stereo, stay in phase. Things don't sound like when you double mic it, like the thing that's supposed to be in the middle is off closer to the left, off closer to the right. You have less phasing issues to deal with when it comes to the two sources, because everything should be, in theory, arriving at the same time. When things arrive at different times, you start getting into that issue of, once again, comb filtering, which is honestly just not great. When you actually get a chance, if you ever want to test this, even if you have two microphones that are different, you can still hear this effect. Just find a speaker, point the two microphones at it with their capsules being aligned as close as you can to them, right next to each other, and then take one of the microphones and pull it back or push it forward, just incrementally. It could be a quarter of an inch or anything. You'll start to hear something go like, it's just the wildest sound. But this is kind of what we're trying to avoid with these multi-miking techniques, which is also the reason why we talk about this subject, which is sometimes it's better to just use one mic. Sometimes, as much as we want to mitigate the issues, it's not always the easiest way to mitigate these issues. So you'll see a lot of people still doing like a mono overhead and then spot miking certain cymbals. That's pretty common practice. You'll still see people who will use like a mono room mic and then will actually use like reverbs and all that kind of stuff to kind of recreate like the side ones. Or they'll put far out microphones in the corners of the rooms to when recording drums and then using that as like the stereo part of the room mics, but they'll still have to time align that to like the actual room mic, the mono one that they set up to capture the majority of the drum set. And they'll use those far out ones like quietly blended under to kind of create like more depth of room and stereo field. But you're having to battle all these decisions. And this is where over miking becomes the issue. That's why this topic has kind of come to mind. There's nothing wrong with wanting to throw 100 mics, but there is a problem with the amount of time you're wasting trying to align them all and get them all to sound good together when maybe 10 mics on the drum set is all you needed. Yeah. You know, not a vocal doesn't need to have that natural room sound unless you're absolutely looking to dedicate the time to miking, let's say, the downstairs chamber at Capitol, and then putting two mics up there and making sure the reverb is not comb filtering against itself and then blending that in with the vocal. Who knows? Maybe that comb filtering sounds nice. But that's kind of the decision that you need to make on a creative stance. Same way I mentioned earlier about stereo recording a vocal. Unless you're doing it for a creative reason, there's really not a big benefit to it.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about like the cohesive phase of each instrument stacked and like the position in the room too. Cause like, for example, we've talked about this trick many times on the podcast in different episodes. But like, especially when it comes to solo strings or solo horns or woodwinds, and you want to stack them, for whatever reason, a singular violin, a singular trumpet, stacked multiple times will always go out of phase. Always. Like, in some way or another, it's horrible. And it sounds fake and it sounds unnatural. So how do you get a synthetic stack or synthetic, like, band or orchestra from a single? Yeah, or like, well, that's the thing too. It's like with vocalists, they're not like perfect. Vocalists aren't perfectly in tune. Like the micro sense that they're off and the timing that are like milliseconds off from each other will keep vocals from usually going out of phase, right? So this is specifically like an instrument thing. And for some reason, us strings and horns especially, because again, with guitars, they go slightly out of tune with like how you, when you pluck the string goes like a couple cents out of tune just because of the tension when you actually pluck it, right? So whatever the reason is, the actual logistical reason, strings and horns are naturally always out of phase and like cause a lot of comb filtering. So the way to solve that and mitigate that is if you must stack, which you should try not to, because it always sounds better to have multiple horn players in the room and stacking a group of horn players multiple times rather than a single individual multiple times. But if you must do a single individual multiple times, have them record with different, like if they have two trumpets, have them bring both, play both of them, move around in the studio, like move the mic, move the person around, play from different positions in the room, switch instruments in the, like face the opposite direction, like play into the wall and have the microphone pick up the reflections. Like whatever the thing is, you have to move around and create some sort of variance in order to make sure that the phase is slightly different. Because if the phase only like crashes or like cancels each other out and becomes a problem when they're near identical, if they're wildly different, then it's actually, it's less likely that they'll have phase problems. Like you'll lose phase correlation for a long enough sustained amount of time where it becomes audible, right? Mm-hmm. So again, just make sure that they're slightly different and they are just different instruments, different players, different parts in the room, move back, move forward, move the mic around. And with, especially with instruments like that, like if you're going to stack them, what you got to do is you got to remember that air is a really great mixer as well.
Yes.
Like as in like, don't get too close to the instrument. Like this is why you need a nice studio room, because if it's controlled and it's like a nice sounding room and you have a good sounding mic, like have the saxophone player step back, have the violin soloist step back away from the mic. Like it really does improve the sound of that instrument quite a bit. Depending on context too. Because also if you close mic a violin, you get a lot more like shrill upper mids and high end. And then you record an orchestra that's like you take a step back and ever all the mics are a little bit further back, you'll notice that it's a lot more warmth and a lot less high end. And that has a totally different sound and can be used totally differently and is used in arrangement differently, is used in production differently, right? Just from that simple tone shift. So that's something to consider as well.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
You know, and that's actually something that's huge because this is almost exclusively studio because in a live situation, like you don't always have the benefit of space because the further you are away from the source and the louder you want to make it, let's say in somebody's monitor, the easier it is for the monitor to feed back and all that kind of stuff. So this is huge in studio world because in live, you have this situation where there's kind of a drummer already there. And if the venue's small, you almost don't really need to mic up everything on the drums because it's going to be heard throughout the entire room. So you're kind of just reinforcing that sound anyways, which just kind of shows like if you want things to sound natural, we're kind of already hearing the instrument in the room. So we don't really need to reinforce everything. So that's where like a room mic really comes into play and moving that mic around like in the mix. One of the most, I don't know, DK, you correct me if I'm wrong on this one. I don't know how much drum tracking you did in the mix, but one of my favorite things to do was point a 57 at the diffuser that we had in the back corner of the live room. Like, don't even point it at the drums, just point it at the diffuser. And it actually just sounded really nice. It made the room sound even bigger than it was. And then that actually got used a lot in the mixes that I was, you know, using those drums in. It was just a way of adding room to something where everything is close mic. Because to mic a tom, you know, you kind of want it pretty close. We're really talking about like anywhere between like an inch off of the skin to like 6 inches, like depending on the tone you want out of it. But like for drummers that use more toms than they actually need, which is not as common, but it's pretty common in like, I want to say smaller acts. Like the drummer that wants to be Mike Portnoy when really he just needs a snare and a floor tom. You know, you don't have a lot of space. Sometimes you're close miking the shit out of it. And if all you have is close mics, it just doesn't feel very natural. And then panning those elements around just don't feel, you know, familiar to you. Cause when we listen to a drum set in person or we go see a band live or something, you know, we're kind of familiar with their sound as just an acoustic source in a room, right? So using like room mics and all that to kind of like help you distinguish where you want to pan the toms or using your overheads as like a panning decider, like, oh, well, the tom in the overheads is only really like 20% to the right. So that's when I put like the rack tom. these kind of elements help. That's why you see a lot of people kind of like crushing room mics and all that to kind of like give the sense of ambience back, the sense of energy back, because close miking doesn't always give you that. So sometimes, like DK said, air is kind of your best friend. Like if you want the guitar cab to sound bigger, instead of miking it right on the grill, pull the mic back a couple inches. You'd be surprised how much bigger it feels in the mix just by pulling it back an inch or two.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, again, we're talking about the nature of recorded audio using a single instrument with a single mic, a single source, multiple times stacked, which is different from having 10 mics on a drum kit, which is a single source, but recorded simultaneously. And now you're talking about a phase that doesn't change because those distances from the mic doesn't really change, right?
Yeah.
Because when a snare drum goes through an overhead versus the direct mic versus through the tom mic, how the timing, like the microsecond timing that the sound going through the air hits the microphone, the membrane, right? Mm-hmm. That will change. That doesn't change between each hit. That stays the same. So if you fix the phase either through the console, like flipping the phase in the console, or through some sort of outboard gear in the preamp or in post, you fix it and check it once, it should be good for the rest of the recording. And this does have a big effect on mixes, especially. I literally had a mix this last week that we still haven't even finished approval yet. Hopefully we'll have that done by tomorrow. There was four sample drums, different samples. It was just a kick and snare, kind of like a pop four on the floor type thing. Mm-hmm. And the samples were not perfectly lined up. Like two of the four hits were lined up and then the other two hits were not. And mm-hmm. so instead of trying to EQ or doing anything like that, I zoomed in real close, edited and aligned those kick drums together and those snare drums together, and then copy and pasted that aligned kick and snare to the other kick and snares, so they were perfectly aligned every single time. That all of a sudden made the kick drum substantially louder, much heavier, like deeper, like the it went deeper.
I'm sure
and much more
transient.
Impactful.
Yeah,
the transient, of course. So it's just something like that, and it's one of those things where it's like you fix the timing once, it fixes on all of them. It's worth taking the time to fix that.
Yeah.
So
now, if you're working with, let's say, a recorded source, like we're not talking recording at this point, but like rather a recorded source, and you're trying to get things to sound wider, and it's really just a mono source. It could be a bass line. It could be a guitar. It could be a vocal. It could be anything that's really just mono, and it's already recorded. There are a couple things that you could do. We lightly touched on one, which is the Nashville trick, which once again is just taking guitar, pan it hard right, and then put a reverb on that or a very short delay of some sort, and then pan that hard left, you know. And in doing that, you kind of make it feel not so isolated on the right, and it just makes it feel a little bit bigger. But there are things that we've used. I know I'm a big fan. I don't know if you are, DK, of using like a really wide doubler on vocals and like kind of tucking it under to kind of create like, not necessarily like a room tone, but just kind of like an added width that lays under the vocal.
Yeah. So if we want to get into this, this is slightly different from multi-mics and phase correlation. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about now specifically adding width to a vocal, I mean, yeah, lots of people use like a micro shift from Sound mm-hmm. Toys or something similar, like a chorus of some kind, some sort of modulation as a send, and then blending that into the lead vocals to add some width, mm-hmm. Which is potentially messing with phase. There's something called like Haas effect, and there's a couple plugins that purposefully add Haas effect, which is just delaying one side like by a couple milliseconds. So it makes it feel more separated. It's not perfect. It's a little bit artificial, but it actually is pretty useful. There's even the idea, one of my favorite things to do directly on the source is putting on like Ozone's Imager and then turning on that widener button and keeping it at like 6 milliseconds and then slowly turning that up. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But that's one of my favorite artificial wideners. There's also plugins like Center from Waves, or like a free plugin from get good hertz, like mid-side matrix, where you can literally just turn down the mid signal and turn up the side signals. Yeah, there's like different ways to do it. Now, I think one of the most underrated things, and I think this is like one of my secret sauces here that I love to use all the time, is like I think that people underutilize very short room reverbs.
Yeah.
Or even if you just use like, there's plugins that don't even do reverbs. It's literally just.
Just room.
Yeah, like not slap.
Pre-delay.
Yeah, it's literally just the pre-delay or like the first, what do you call it? First reflections. So yeah. It's not even like any sustain or decay. It's literally just like a slap. It's like a specific algorithm.
Valhalla Room.
That's like a reverb with decay too. But there's also plugins that don't have any decay, don't do any room emulation. It's just first reflection. Mm-hmm. And that even that alone gives it a sense of like context. And there's something in our brains that like our brain is naturally inferring where the space is coming from, what it sounds like. And you can mess with phase and how like all of this different stuff. And there's different algorithms to do that, which makes it like that's where you get like the binaural sound where like if you've ever heard like 3D Barbershop on YouTube, where it's like a binaural haircut and like, but they put the clippers behind you and you can hear the buzzer behind your head and it really feels like it's right behind your head. That's just phase manipulation and how the ears are shaped and like the phase shifting that happens from sound going behind your ears. That's why like binaural recordings are usually done. Literally the microphones are inside the ear canals of a dummy head.
Yep.
So it's like the sound of buzzers coming from behind a big circular head, behind flaps of ear, and then into the ear canal where the microphones are. The way that the phase is shifted from that, how do you call that? Like that shape, like that obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely is recognizable to the human brain. That's why we get binaural. So I'm getting a little off track here.
No, you're totally good. But this is actually kind of exactly what I'm talking about. Like there are ways to make things sound like they have more depth and space in a mix, more width, without having to necessarily overdo the process. Yeah. And a lot of this, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes feels like it's like kind of a given after a certain point, but not very obvious at the beginning stages, because a lot of times we overfocus on, well, this is a quality microphone. And a lot of people say they hear great depth and transient information from this one. Like my favorite thing to use on overheads, anytime I have a chance to use it, is the R88 from AEA Microphones. I just fucking love that thing. It's fucking butter on toast and on the best bread on earth. The thing is that, you know, if I'm totally fine with just those two ribbon capsules, you know, over the drums, and I feel like I've got almost everything, it's just kind of proof to me that I don't need a million mics causing more phase cancellation issues, things like that. Sometimes the simple tricks, like for instance, the behind the head thing, a lot of time results from like, once again, like phase manipulation, but also like rounding off of the top end, which, funny enough, like phasing usually affects low end faster because it's the thing that we can hear get affected the fastest.
Waveforms are bigger. The waveforms are bigger.
But the obstruction from our ear shapes or lobes or whatever part is being directly affected by the sound from behind us is obstructing its ability to get to the eardrum, but low end has an easier time. So sometimes it's filtering off the top end. So if you want things to sound a little bit further away, sometimes you just need a little bit of EQ. You know, not everything needs a million microphones. Not everything needs a room mic. And to be honest, if you want to have more clarity in your mix, if you want things to sound huge, one of my favorite things I hear repeated all the time is do less. You want the drums to sound massive in your band and everything, try not using 1,000 mics. Just try making those few mics really stand out in the mix with less obstruction, without less comb filtering happening, with less, just anything. Get everything that could have been in its way out of the way and watch how those things really slam through the speakers. Sometimes that means just one mic on the kick drum. You know, you don't need a beta 91 or 2, whatever the boundary mic model number is, inside the kick, and then a 902 outside the kick. That's my personal favorite combination. But in times where there's no port on the kick drum, one of my favorite things to do is actually put a boundary mic right on the floor in between the floor tom, the kick, and snare. Just stick that sucker on the floor and watch how much it picks up of the drums. But because it's such in such a spot, it makes the drums sound bigger because it's taking everything as like a cohesive capture of the area. You hear the kick drum, you hear the beater, you hear the floor tom, you hear this bottom of the snare in that mic and everything. And when you blend it in, it sounds a lot more natural than if I had a Beta 91 inside the kick and a 902 on the port of the kick. It just, there's something to be said about less is more, even when you're trying to conceptualize it all into this big stereo mix. You're trying to, you know, turn this all into, like, you're not even at the mixing stage, but yet you're already creating the issues by doing too much in the mix, in the recording stage.
Yeah. There's also times where, I'm going to be honest with you, like, how do you say this? Like,
sometimes
when it comes to, yeah. Like with phase and correlation, like this, like, for example, like filters on a synth, or like modulation often does like adds phase issues on purpose, or like even EQ is literally changing the phase.
Yeah.
Of sort, unless you're using a linear phase EQ, which has other problems like pre-ringing, potential problems like pre-ringing.
And latency as well, depending on it.
Yeah, like there's something along the lines of like, if you do too much, if you're trying to do something that sounds natural, like an orchestra, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to do anything crazy to make it sound contrived, you know, unnatural, artificial. But there are times when you're recording other types of music and you want to use filters and like something, and like that sounds cool and you have no idea. You find out later that it's out of phase or whatever. Or like you widen things up artificially, which in turn does make it a little bit less, more out of phase with each other. Like that sounds cool too. Like there's also like there's times where that like unnatural contrived quality is like good. For example, like Leslie Brathwaite, when using like delays with the H delay, he likes to do this thing often where he just flip it, like on the H delay from Waves, you could just flip the phase on one side. So now the right side delay is flipped. And if you put that in a mono, like obviously it might cancel each other out all the time. But nobody's ever listened to songs in mono. And once you flip the phase on one side on a delay, it sounds like you have like this really huge delay. And it becomes more obvious and it doesn't get in the way of everything else in the middle of the mix because it's so out of phase with each other. And it doesn't sound natural, but it sounds fucking cool as hell. You know, like, so I would be careful.
Sometimes
like
bad is good.
I don't know if even the word bad sounds too universal as a concept.
Yeah,
like sometimes things sound like natural and that's the intention. That should be the point. And other times things sound contrived and that's the point. And that's like artificial and unnatural. That's the point. I think the one thing that we should all try to avoid is to not really having a direction or intention with a recording or a mix. Like, does this record need to have a natural orchestral classic tone and timbre to it? Does this want to sound like new age, artificial, synth pop kind of, like, what is the purpose of this record? Like, what is it going to be used for? Who's the art, like potentially you might think, who's the audience? Like just be more mindful with your approach and do things more intentionally. And then as you notice, like as you kind of learn these techniques are supposed to be served as a tool to understand how you can portray your intention better through the limitations of recorded audio as a medium. The last thing you want is to have like a vapid recording or a mix. It's just so dull and boring without zest because it's just like blah. There's no intention behind it.
Yeah.
Right. Like the worst thing about like, I think that bad songs, and this goes into like potentially into proper artistry too, is like bad songs are mostly done with a lack of authenticity and intention.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Here's the problem with authenticity, which we've all heard. The thing that we don't really talk about is the act of trying to be authentic is already in itself inauthentic. Like the thing that, like the thing that recognizes that it's ego and tries to kill the ego is the ego itself. The ego wants to kill the ego. Like you can't try to, like you just have to be like spontaneous and not overthinking things. So how, like, this is the question, the lifelong question is, how do you go back to not overthinking things without returning back to a state of naivety? Or do you balance naivete as like a weapon to be utilized? Like, who's to say? I can't say that for you. And this is the problem with the ambiguous nature of art in itself and of life in itself. So, the worst thing that you can do as a creative, as an artist, is to not be mindful and to do things because we tell you to, or to not think thoroughly through things. There's no point of following all the rules by the T. It's also not productive to not learn the rules. You have to know what the rules are and then how to artistically and mindfully break them. Right? Cool. Anything else to say about that?
Not really, but if there's a really good resource to somebody who I personally really like, a lot of people see him as kooky for whatever reason, but I kind of get it. He seems like I don't know. I like people with personalities that are unfiltered, but Dave Ratt. Dave Ratt is a really good source of information when it comes to, I guess you could say, how stereo imaging can be utilized both in studio and not, because he teaches it from a technical and practical standpoint. A lot of people know him as like the Red Hot Chili Peppers engineer. And as one of the only guys in the industry who still uses, like, and there's obviously more, but I said one of the only guys still left in the industry who use like an analog board live, which is wildly impractical, which it just begs the question of like, what's your logic behind it? But I was really happy to find that this guy is actually sound in his information. Like even when you fact check him, he still comes out right on the money. But it comes from a very practical, real world, real professional, hired gun for, you know, the rich and the famous engineer, you know. So it's just as good advice from somebody who's practicing it as somebody who actually educates people on it. And he does real world videos of, this is how it's used, this is how it's communicated, let me show you the truth. Like he even has a video of showing the difference between Cat 5E and 6A cables. Like, you know, you're a fucking nerd when you have to show me audible and digital proof of the difference in these cables and at different lengths, like the difference between a 50-foot one and a 100-foot one. Like, nobody asked, but I did ask one day. And so thank you for having already made the video for the question that nobody asked up until that point. Yeah. So Dave Ratt is a really good resource when it comes to stereo imaging, phasing, and things of that nature, because he's not only just an engineer, but he's also one of the speaker designers for companies like EAW. And he also tech specs a lot of like the biggest festivals in the United States. So understanding sound from a fundamental point to where you're throwing up like 30 to 100 speakers at a time together without comb filtering being a major issue is an impressive amount of information you have to understand. So if you'd like to learn more about how comb filtering, time delays, and all those kind of things play a part into whether you're doing studio, setting up your own speakers in your own room, miking up sources and ways that you can make things sound more natural while without having to go into phase cancellation or widener tools, he's a really good resource for that. And like I said, he kind of seems like a kooky uncle, but give him a chance and I promise you, you won't regret it.
Yeah. Also, you saying that made me realize I'm going to disagree with something that I said a little bit earlier.
Sure.
There's lots of people who never learn the rules and still make hits. Yeah. They don't care about them at all. Yeah. And
there's the notion, learn the rules, then break them. Because
yeah, I disagree with that actually. I think you should, like as a craftsman, you should learn your craft. Yeah. And if you really care about your craft, you will naturally learn more. Yep. But I don't think there's any sort of like geeky. I think anybody can make a hit if they have enough passion and drive and then trust in their own taste, even if that is completely, completely like childish, childlike, spontaneous, or uneducated, ignorant. Like there's still everybody has taste. you know, and you can, you can figure out a way to get to that taste by just trial and error.
Yeah.
Right. And then having unreasonable confidence in your taste. Mm-hmm. I think that's okay.
Have a Kanye level of confidence in everything you do in life.
Yeah, manic bipolar confidence. That's crazy. Anyway, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're kind of losing the plot on phase and multi-miking.
We're just having fun with it.
Couple other thoughts. There's a couple other thoughts that I think I do have. Like I've been asked, like, how do you think about like club mixes or like like AM radio when everything's going to be shifted to mono? Like, do you care about phase? Like, hell no.
No,
I've never once bounced a mix and wondered, oh, I wonder if this is going to sound good in a club. Yeah. I wonder if this is going to sound good on AM radio. Not once thought that.
Like the most people think is like, let me play this on my Alexa and see what it sounds like on my Alexa.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to think about that, like, why don't you think about the compression that the song is going to go through when they play it on FM radio?
Yeah.
The normalization and the compression, like that affects the sound a lot too, but why is nobody talking about that? Like, so do you leave mixes extra dynamic for the radio just because you know it's going to get doubly compressed when it, like, no, nobody thinks about that shit. Like, nobody cares. Yeah. Like, that's not. Yeah, we're losing the plot there. So I think, there are times that you should be thinking about phase and there's some artistic quality to it. Like, I'm thinking like old school engineers that were forced to, due to the limitations of technology, were forced to record entire bands in a single room all the time and have a bunch of like foam panels and what are those called? Like BOGOs?
Oh, egg crates and all. Oh yeah, gobos, like standing.
Gobos, sorry, wrong. Yeah. Like gobos and a bunch of different like techniques, and like now they're actually artisans and craftsmen of using polar patterns that the microphones are used for in a way that is actually canceling each other out, like the most effective way.
Yep.
Like that is kind of a lost art because we don't need to do that anymore due to the lack of technological limitations.
Yeah.
Like, so, I mean, it's still a useful craft, a useful thing to techniques to know, but we're not limited by that anymore. So just consider, like, for example, like we used to have to mono the bass in all of our masters and recordings because vinyl couldn't handle it. Like you couldn't press a stereo bass into the metal mother, and duplicate that vinyl without the needle popping out. That was the reason why you had to mono the bass. And now that is not, that's a non-issue. That is a complete non-issue. And if that is an issue,
pressing to vinyl.
Yeah. And at that point you have to hire a mastering engineer, kind of go through a process of mastering it specifically for vinyl anyway.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, it's a complete non-issue. So to a certain degree, don't overthink it. And
as you sharpen your knife, information will come through. Do with it what you will.
But yeah, sometimes, like, don't make things overly wide unless your brain says, this could be better if it was slightly wider because it'll make it more energetic. Yeah. Like, let your brain say that first before trying to figure out how to make something wide.
Yeah.
Like, have that idea in your head. Use that taste that you've been built with, that you have.
Yeah.
Whether or not you like it or not, or even if you're good or bad at mixing, you have taste. And I think people that make bad mixes or bad songs are like the most removed from that sense of taste that everybody has. Even if I subjectively think it's a shitty taste, you should still dive into it.
Yeah. Like, I hate to admit it to this day, but some of my favorite songs are some of the worst mixed songs. There's just a vibe.
There's, and not just like songs that you like, some of the most played, most streamed songs, most popular songs of all time are like relatively shitty mixes.
Actually, I have a question for you. Just a needle point timeline, this one. Like, yes, no, two sentences as to why. You just went to go see Earth, Wind & Fire, didn't you?
Yeah, at the Hollywood Bowl.
Okay, I'm going to quote you. If anybody ever remasters or changes the mixes to September, I'm going to fucking kill them. How did you think that the live mix / performance, obviously, depending where you sit, depends what things sound like and all that. But how do you feel like the modern day live sounding version of it portrayed the record to you to now? did it still feel organically the same? Or, you know, obviously performers change over time and things like that, you know?
Yeah, well, that's like also we're comparing apples to oranges here because the joy of live is that it's different, right?
Exactly.
So they had different arrangements and whatnot, but yeah.
But did Earth it still feel organic and authentic to you to the record?
Yeah. It was a similar tempo, similar vibe. Obviously, the performers are getting old. It wasn't perfect. They did rely a lot on backing tracks, you could tell. Mm-hmm. But it was, that's not like, you're not comparing. You don't go to a live show to compare to the fidelity of the record. You go knowing that it's going to be different from the record, right? Yeah. The problem with remastering or remixing or like, for example, like in the original September, the trumpets are off and like mm-hmm. fixing that sort of stuff or like actually balancing the tonal spectrum to like be a little bit more low end heavy to like relative to modern records. Like now you're taking something that should be re-experienced the same exact way and changing the experience, which is different. Right. Now you're taking something that's not meant to be experienced differently and changing the experience, which might be cool, but like there's nostalgia in tone and there is nostalgia in consistency of like, for example, like I'm not a live guy. Mm-hmm. I grew up listening to records on the radio where or like recorded audio, recorded music. So like that repetition and repeatability is the nostalgia for me. I want to be exactly the same every single time. Like I hate to admit this, like the art of live audio and live performance for me is a completely different thing, which I have significantly less passion for. Mm-hmm. It's still music. It's still art, but that's not the format of art that I listen to music. Like I like recorded repeatable music. Like this, some sort of like it feels like canon. Like this is the original documented music. And yeah, it may not ever have the energy or the randomness or the spontaneity of a live thing, but that's just my preference for how I like listening to music. I don't feel a subjective emotional enhancement difference necessarily or, going to live. Yeah, no, there's definitely a difference, but I don't find, for me, like I...
You're not finding like an enjoyable difference as much as the medium that you're used to.
Same thing with like movies too. Like I grew up watching movies almost every night, especially like middle school, high school. Like we had a projector in our house, like not necessarily like a movie room, but like instead of having a TV in our main room, we always had a projector like for like entire 10 years of my middle school and high school life. And like when we watched a movie almost every single night as a family or by myself, my nostalgia for film is watching it at home. I have no need. I like some people like will like the entire point of the movie is to experience it at the theater.
Yeah.
That's not how I grew up experiencing movies. So for me, like going and finding parking, getting out of your house is just a roadblocks to the experience, which is at home, comfy. You can talk during the movie, be loud with your friends, pause the movie, create commentary, like get up, use the bathroom without missing anything, get some butter on your popcorn.
What it's like at the theater. If somebody got up and was like, hey, can you guys pause the movie? I got to take a shit.
And that's not me saying that it's superior, right? It's not superior. Yeah. I'm saying that that's just my comfort of movies. And my comfort of like audio and music. Like I can't be a live sound person because that's just not how I prefer music. And that's not like a slash against live music. That's not a slash against anybody that likes it. It's just a preference thing.
Yeah.
And there's people that like
that. Cause I was like, I'm curious as to, you know, for being as much of a fan of that record as you are, or how much you use it as a reference point in that example. I'm like, I wonder what his, experience was. Being the Hollywood Bowl is a very famous venue.
It was great. It sounded great.
As a good sounding spot. Obviously, things can change depending on the engineer systems and all put into place. But
it was a good show. They're definitely
they're
getting
a big
older.
Group, you know, I'm sure they got a good team.
Yeah, it was a good show. It was a fun show. That was. We love Earth, Wind, and Fire. It was for Kaname's birthday. He turned 7, and he loves Earth, Wind, and Fire. I covered September as a band since he was in the womb. It's like there's something about listening to music while in the womb. Like he came out and that was like a soothing thing for him. Like he would be crying and then all of a sudden I'd play September. And then all of a sudden, even as a baby, like days old, he would be soothed to September just because that's what it was, comfort thing. He heard it in the womb. That's is cool. My guess. Yeah.
Did you place headphones on the belly?
No. I just was in a band and Kayako went to every live show, you know?
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering. I know some people who have told me in the past that are like, yeah, you know, I wanted the best odds for my kid to have perfect pitch, so we would play like tones. And I'm like, I don't know if that's how that works, but I mean, let me know how it goes. You know, their kids aren't old enough for me to know yet.
It's been a while since I looked at like the stats, the number, the studies on this. First off, it's like pretty genetic. So I think in non-tonal language countries and cultures and languages, I think like 25 to 30% of people have the genetic capability, like the genetic code to be able to develop perfect pitch. And then with like tonal language countries, most like Chinese, you know, and Vietnamese, for example, like it's like it goes up to 50%.
Nice.
Again, it's been a long time since I've seen the studies on this.
Yeah.
Which is even 30% is significantly higher because it's 1 in 10,000 people. It's about 1 in 10,000 people that develop perfect pitch. There's also some studies that, if I remember correctly, that show growing up being exposed to high content music like jazz or classical music, where there's multiple melodies going on. Different time and modalities and keys and stuff where it's like the music is a lot more complex, has them develop like more, I hate to say it like this, like more intellectually, music with much more intellectual and musical depth than like regular pop music with the same 2 to 4 chords, right?
Makes sense.
Which is nothing wrong with that, right? But yeah, so in our family, we are a jazz, fusion, alt jazz, and funk family by nature. Again, Japanese 80s and like stuff like that. So we listen to musically complex music at home for fun. And that's what I listen to. Even though I mix pop, I listen to a lot of like jazz and alternative jazz and funk, like high energy jazz, not like boring elevator jazz necessarily, like hot jazz. But that's what we listen for fun. And so Kaname grew up listening to like, for example, Dirty Loops, Corey Wong, Wolf Peck. Like that's like his normal, like Japanese 80s city pop. Like that's Earth, Wind & Fire. That's like his normal music that he grew up listening to. And yeah, he has perfect pitch now. Completely on accident. We didn't train him for it. He just has it now.
Nice.
Yeah. And he knows, now it's just a problem of putting the tones to letters, like recognition. So he can sing C and G out of nowhere, but he doesn't, like, he can't do like E flat because he doesn't like the name to the note. I haven't taught him that yet. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I can't sing for shit. So,
and it's completely natural. We found out because like he kept requesting us to play songs in the car. We're like, which song? And he doesn't remember the song name, so he kept like singing the song, the one that goes like this, and he sings it. And then I play the song, and every single time he requests the song in the same exact key that the song is in, and that's not an accident. After a while, I picked up that's not an accident. Turns out he can do that every single time. He doesn't understand how he's able to do it or like that's crazy at all. He's just able to do that.
Yeah, it's something that I've debated in the past. I'm like, when you have a fundamental understanding of something, whether it be natural or not, does it sour the taste of the other grapes? Like you've had a very sweet and sour green grape before, and taste of it. So like when you have one that's not as sour or sweet as the last, does it sour the rest of them for you? Like they all have to be the perfect grape. Like, so when you're like pitch perfect, does listening to a song that was kind of intentionally out of key or slightly off, like for instance, Ari Lennox is one of my favorite R&B female singers right now. And I think part of the reason that I like it is because she's kind of intentionally just kind of letting tune be loose. Like I know that her producers sometimes may want her to be a little more in key here and there, but she's like, yeah, but it just doesn't feel natural to me. And she's used to hearing like natural jazz vocalists and soul vocalists. A lot of people who go to church that have like big groups and all that perform sometimes don't want the auto-tune, even though auto-tune is possible live, even when people don't think it is possible, but not everybody wants it. It just affects the performer in a way that they don't feel good about. So like does somebody with perfect pitch not, do they appreciate it more? Like saying like, wow, you went out there with it? Or does it kind of create an irk or something?
Okay, so you should ask the individuals because every individual is going to have a different answer.
Exactly, yeah.
But having many perfect pitch friends across cultures, a couple biased personal observations is that very few people across cultures actually are super nitpicky about like when things are slightly out of tune or like when things were recorded to like 432 or whatever that, not 440, you know, like whatever it is. Yeah. I've had one perfect pitch person that says that the 432 hertz or whatever, I forgot what the other alternative tuning method is, to him sounds more natural and sounds more correct than 440. He says 440 sounds less natural. Like, that's not how I hear the pitch. I hear 432. Like, but he specifically is not trained at all with music.
Interesting.
Like, he's never learned an instrument until college, you know. So he's just, he was explaining to me how that's interesting to him because that's just how he naturally perceives it without being trained in music. He just has perfect pitch.
See, and I find those viewpoints sometimes more fascinating and interesting. Because I feel like, I guess education can sometimes feed an ego and that ego feeds a decision or a viewpoint. But when you have no training in something, I almost feel your response is a bit more natural and not based on what you want to be perceived as.
Yeah. Okay. So hold on. So to finish this story too, like anybody, we're way off topic, by the way. I don't even give a shit.
I think that's okay.
The only people that have openly complained about how something is specifically off and it's bothering them are the same people, are the same type. Okay. Have you ever met an engineer that's like, oh, I really can't enjoy this song because the EQ's off and the compression's off and it's just not well recorded?
Yes.
They might be right. But the fact that they're making a big deal out of it is this them wanting to get flowers.
Yeah.
You know, it's not real. It's not a real authentic reaction. They're just being stupid and facetious, you know? Yeah, it's the same thing with like, yeah, people that are bothered by that, like it's slightly out of tune or it's like, oh, it needs to be perfect pitch, are the same people that like are highly clinging to their identity as a perfect pitch person and like want to use that as a sort of like validation or dominance on others and just like wants to make it a talking point so they say it out loud. Like it's not like people, for most people, it almost never, from what I understand, it never bothers perfect pitch people. I sing things out of tune all the time to kind of make, because I'll just start singing randomly and I know for sure that I'm not singing the right key. Not once has he brought it up. Same thing with like my three really close friends that have perfect pitch. I also noticed that the only ones that have complained about like doing things like that, like for the sake of showing that they have perfect pitch, you know, being really facetious like that. It's like, oh, this bothers me because it's out of key or whatever. There were Americans. I've never heard a Japanese person be bothered by that.
Yeah.
Like Japanese people with perfect pitch, like they've like, that's just also, that's like a cultural thing that I'm projecting. Availability heuristic might be involved in that as well. But yeah, like you don't,
I think one of the funniest things I've ever heard related to like pitch complaints was, I didn't take it any kind of way, but I know some people would, but I think people are just too far up their own ass to understand it because it's kind of true. Like Mexican corridos and banda music and all that is pretty horribly sung half the time. It's usually like voices that you would otherwise like in a pop music culture like in America, sure, they're not Katy Perry, sure, they're not fucking I don't know, Usher or whoever has a nice voice. You get what I'm saying with these references, but like, sure, like when I listen to Bad Bunny, I don't think, what a handsome voice. I think the dude sounds like he's got a bunch of water in his mouth. You know what I mean? Like, I understand what he's saying. I speak Spanish and that's cool and I understand the cultural relevance, but that's kind of the vibe. And sometimes the vibe matters more than the tonality of it. So like when I listen to like banda music and everything, yes, the singer is very often off pitch.
That's a really good metaphor.
Yeah, but it's very, very culturally relevant to be okay with that because we're in a lot of Latin music, it's a lot of emotion. Like Vicente Fernandez was very famously the honest man, where one of his songs is about how he's talking in the perspective of the song, he's talking to the girl that he's no longer with, acá entre nos, here between the you and I, essentially is the title of the song, Between You and I. He's telling him, like, between you and I, I'm still in love with you. I'm not over you. But in front of the guys, I'm not going to lie, I even wished for your own death in front of them just to try to, like, impress them and show them that I moved on. But I haven't moved on, you know, so, like, he's singing with a very emotional tone, and he's not always going to be perfectly in key, but he was seen as one of the best singers and closest to it. But then everybody else who covers his songs are pretty famously off key too. So
yeah,
it's like to go perfect pitch with it just doesn't sound natural. And in fact, perfect pitch just doesn't feel right.
Yeah. Like I've never like very usually anybody born with perfect pitch or have the ability of perfect pitch, it is not a tool that separates them from the art. Mm-hmm. Like for most people, that's not something that makes it impossible for them to like enjoy music.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily correlate to the need for like the need for specific structure. That's a mm-hmm. still a personality thing. Yeah. Has nothing to do with the skill of perfect pitch itself. It's just one of those things where like, as people that don't have that sense, we'll never understand. And I'm very biased and I'm just speaking on perspective and I'm probably wrong. And I'm not speaking on behalf of everybody with perfect pitch. There's probably people that have perfect pitch listening to this podcast that have completely different experiences, right? So I'm open to that and I understand mm-hmm. I'm not part of that. Yeah, anyway, it's just a fascinating thing, I think, in general. I don't want to get into that topic. Never mind. I know it's way late at the end of the episode. We want to shout out all of our new Patreon audience members. I'm going to try to do this every episode from now on. Thank you so much to Gary Sheba, John D. Murphy, Yochem Villain, Luis Hernandez, Justice Jimenez, Rashi, Tyler Ming, Feli Landveld, Danielle Picora, Caleb. Daniel Picora is doing like the double tier, is like giving us the extra tip. Thank you, Daniel. You get like, platinum member. Maybe we should distinguish you somehow. Christian Ellis, Jared Barnum, Floxlovin, Yannick, Dominic Flugel, Elias Lamb, Adio, and of course, Jason Parsley, Mighty Made Fellows. Thank you so much for being active paid members of our Patreon for your patronage. And thank you to all of our free members as well. There's a lot more free members. And you get free stuff from just joining our Patreon. Once again, that's mixingmusicpodcast.com/Patreon to get access. Just join up for our free tier. And you get some PDFs, access to some PDFs. If we ever do anything like practice stems or anything like that, bonus material or content, we put it up for our free members. So might as well just sign up. On that note, we love you. Happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy. Psst. Hey, you. Yeah, you. Come join our Discord. The Mixing Music Discord server is filled with tons of awesome information and people. People that can help you out and information that can help you grow your business and to help you improve your mixes. So come join us and find the invitation link at mixingmusicpodcast.com.